some updates, and some new news today. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today, as usual, is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Great to be back with you in this kind of rainy day, but, we got to have the rain in order for the plants to grow. And I'm looking at my wife's garden, looking pretty good.
Yeah, it is looking good. And I think everything is starting to look really good because we are seemingly back into a normal cycle for everything going. I mean, we've had a couple of heavy rain days and, you know, there was some weird weather early on. It got real hot when it should have been cold and cold when it should have been hot. But I think really things are starting to settle and line up the way they should normally.
Well, you accused me last week, I think, of being my home state being Michigan, which is false. I was born in Kansas, but reared in Ohio. I went to Michigan for about 11 years. And let me tell you what I see here with these days and nights that we're having, the warm days and the cool nights. This is looking like Central Michigan, a lot like it. 85, 88 during the day, but 55, 58 at night.
Mm-hmm.
This is what it looks like.
Yeah, it does. You've waited all week to get back at me on that little slide,
that's right,
about you being from Michigan.
That's right. I am a Michigan State grad, and I will say go green, go white. And the green and white flag does go up when Michigan State plays Ohio State basketball, football, or if I catch it in hockey or whatever. But I am an Ohio boy.
Okay, well, we'll give you that one, and my apologies profusely for that, because we don't want to claim you're from somewhere when you're not. Although the born in Kansas thing, I gotta start wondering now. We're not in Kansas anymore, Toto. Anyhow, we were talking about things getting back to normal, Charles.
Yes,
and things will be getting back to normal. Now, this is not a normal week for us because, well, when people hear this program on Saturday, you and I will be frantically doing the last-minute preparations and probably starting on the trip to go to Camp American.
Yep.
Because it starts on Sunday the 15th on the beautiful shores of Lake James at Pokagon State Park in Angola, Indiana. And folks, if you haven't signed your 12-year-old up to come to Camp American, you still have a wee little window of time to get them in there, because we will take all the way up to the afternoon of sign-in of if we've got space available. So call ahead, please, if we have space available to get your camper in there. We're all looking forward to it. My kids are giddy about it. We go up every year, except for the bird year.
Yes.
We won't talk about the bird year now, but we go up every year because it's a great place to have some family vacation time, to relax, to learn things, because some of the fantastic, top-notch, A-rated speakers that Chuck and the staff get in for camp each year. And we're really excited this year because we've got Larry Pratt coming from Gun Owners of America. You got Tom DeWeese from the American Policy Center. And one I'm especially looking forward to because I've read his books, I've read his articles, I've even heard some of his podcasts, but hearing him live and how he interacts is Dr. Joel McDermott from American Vision. I am really looking forward to this, of querying him on a few things, including what it's like to be Gary North's son-in-law.
Well, I'm looking forward to that as well. That's one thing you get when you come to Camp American, especially if you come as an adult or as a student. The students are busy usually doing
fun things.
They're doing fun things. The adults are sitting around networking and talking and meeting each other and finding out how we all tick and asking the speakers questions.
Right, because, Chuck, and maybe most people don't get this, our speakers, unless it's a special circumstance that they're just tied up and they're just wedging it into our schedule, usually come and stay for a few days, work with the, come around, talk to people, interact with everybody. It isn't like one of these deals where you come, the guy comes in, they fly him in, he goes up, he gives his canned speech, and then they fly him back out again. That's not how camp works. These folks come and oftentimes come for the duration. I know Dr. Kaufman, it's hard to get him away from camp.
Yeah, he doesn't like to leave.
He doesn't like to leave.
He loves to come, he doesn't like to leave.
And the young people get to have one-on-ones with some of these nationally recognized individuals talking about these issues, talking about how they can, even as a young person, impact our culture in so many ways, whether it's on property rights issues and freedom, whether it's on gun rights, whether it's on the pro-life issue, whether it's on just creating a culture of freedom and a culture of Christianity within their own networks. Because really, folks, when you start learning our history and you start learning what we have been mistaught about our history and what the truth of our history is, and the truth being from a faith perspective, you see these young people's eyes light up when they realize that for some of them, now many of them are homeschooled, and even then, some of their materials are not as strong as they need to be, but some of these kids' eyes light up because they never realized this, because that isn't what their teachers at school are exposing them to. They're not telling them of Washington's deep faith, or of the fact of Benjamin Franklin, you know, who is known as one of the, you know, the most famous deists of the founders, actually going, and every time George Whitefield, the preacher, would come anywhere in vicinity where Franklin could go, he would show up there and he would give pretty much, and Franklin was not a poor man either, but he would give lots and lots of money to Whitefield's ministry.
Well, if you read that thing in his autobiography where he says, on purpose, when he found out Whitefield was coming to town, he left his purse at home,
but...
And at the end of Whitefield's, he found himself borrowing money so he could put it in the plate.
Exactly. Now, and again, this isn't revisionist history, ladies and gentlemen. This is what Franklin wrote in his own papers.
Yes,
you know?
Exactly.
But that's the things that our young people, and even our adults, I hate to say it, have never learned about our history. But that's why we love camp so much. That's why we keep doing this year after year. This is a labor of love for the vast majority of us. We don't get paid to do this. Camp is not like, you know, a big moneymaker for Chuck or for his family.
Not hardly.
In fact, it's sometimes a money loser.
In fact, it's funny you say that, because I just had an email today about somebody who said, basically told me they had a friend coming, but they didn't have the heart to tell them that the money they'd come up with wasn't enough because of the deadline passing. Guess what, folks? That deadline. I said, don't bother telling her she needs $50 more. I don't think we've ever charged anybody ever the entire amount after the deadline. That's a dirty little secret. And this is a small enough listening area that only the people on this radio station and our podcast are going to know that. So it doesn't really matter.
Well, the point is that we want to have more and more students come to this. And if finances are an issue, well, we're going to try to figure out a way that you can still get here and still get this information. Because, folks, teaching our young people the truth about our history is the only way we're ever going to restore our republic. That's it. I mean, when they understand the basis, the foundational role of faith, of theology in the founding, when they understand why certain phrases in the Constitution cannot be understood or interpreted correctly without a foundation of faith, then you have to start understanding that what's happening in our current political sphere, and we're going to talk a lot about that today, is honestly something that would cause all of our founders to twirl in their graves.
Well, it's interesting that comes up, because I have been teaching. I just started a new quarter at our church, Providence Presbyterian Church in Pataskala, Ohio. And by the way, folks, if you come 2 weeks from tomorrow when this airs on Sunday, if you come 2 weeks from then, you'll see that we're in a new building. So please come pay us a visit in our new building at Providence Presbyterian Church. We'll be at South Summit Street in Pataskala, Ohio, in what used to be the Cathedral of Praise. It'll be the new Providence Presbyterian Church. We just bought the building. I'm teaching a class on the kings and the prophets. Well, an interesting question came up in the curriculum that I'm using, and that question, basically the author of the curriculum had basically come out and said that before the kings, that the 12 tribes sort of lived apart and didn't have any contact with one another and acted like separate countries and had very little interaction with each other. And I asked my students if that was true. Well, I had a number of them. You know, I did the old thing, how many think it's true? And I had a few hands. How many think it's false? And I think I had one or two. And how many don't know? Well, of course, the majority, that knowing that I'm asking that question for a reason, so they raised their hand. They thought they knew, but they find out that they don't really know for sure. Well, when I finally explained to them, that was a period of time during the Judges and Joshua, known as the Hebrew Republic. And the fact is that the Hebrew Republic was a confederated republic.
Yes, it was.
Much like the United States was, really, until relatively recently, when the Constitution sort has been swept away, that we now pay lip service to it, but we don't really obey it or follow it. And I explained that there were parallels. I said, please don't get the idea that somehow the Founding Fathers were building a theocracy based on the Hebrew Republic. Did they use it as a model? Oh, they knew about it, and they used it as a model, yes. Were they building the same thing as Joshua and the Judges, you know, were doing and through the law of Moses? No, they weren't. They were building something more akin to something to take over the place of the British Parliament, a more controlled government with a cut up in sections on a Lockean model. But then again, it may be a Lockean model, but the fact is that it was divided that way in the Hebrew Republic. There was, yes, a chief magistrate. There were two houses. There was a house that represented the people, a constituent assembly, if you will, and there was a Senate. And they represented the government of the tribes, of the individual tribes. So is it the same? No, it's not the same. Is it similar? Yeah, it's a very, very much a look-alike model. So when you understand that, and you can find that out, there's actually a great free book available online. It's called The Hebrew Republic, and it's by a guy named E.C. Wines.
Right, who was a pastor.
Who was a pastor. It's a 19th century writer.
But it's easy to read.
It's easy to read, and it is footnoted like you would not believe. So if you want to follow the footnotes.
Oh, and that's a lot of fun. Chuck, this is one thing I hope our listeners, if they take very little else away from what we've ever said on this program, follow the footnotes. Don't just take what somebody says at face value. Look at what their sources are. You know, when we talked about Mark Levin here earlier about the Liberty Amendments, he's basically sole source footnoting, which means he's only taking his information from one place. And then if you go to that one place and you look at their footnotes, you find out that they're not necessarily accurately reporting what the original authors were saying. Those are the things. Now, that takes some work, Chuck.
It does.
But that's the key. We cannot expect to have freedom. We cannot expect to have a restoration of a republic, and we cannot expect to have revival and reformation in this society unless we, who call ourselves Christian, are willing to work.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not talking about your works saving you. I'm not talking about your works, you know, giving you merit. I'm talking about doing what is our proper response to God, which is to work, to use our brains, to use our understanding, because our understanding needs to be through the lens of the Bible. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom and leads to understanding.
Yes.
But understanding is nothing if we let it sit there and be dead and we just take in whatever, you know, the talking head on the radio like us, or the folks in the newspapers or your favorite talk radio personality tells you the truth is. You need to go out there and look at it yourself. And we've got, that's a beautiful part about this.
It's amazing the stuff that basically comes out of people's minds on some issues. Now, for instance, I've been doing a back and forth on Facebook. Someone who basically was saying there is no such thing as eldership or deaconship.
Right.
They're just older people and people who do service in the church. And I said, well, what do you do with 1 Timothy 3 where it says he who seeks an office of overseer or deacon,
yep,
or really usually elder because those are different jobs. The deacon and the overseer are different jobs. Some places it says bishop. It depends on the translation.
Right.
He seeks a noble task.
Exactly.
And I said, the fact is that the Bible is replete with places where it's clear that deacon and elder are specific offices. They have a specific position. Well, I was told that, well, you know, that's just simply the modern translations following the King James Version lead. That's not really what that translation says. So I said, okay, fine. Let's go to the Greek interlinear.
Yes.
And the Greek interlinear says specifically about supervision.
And officers,
well,
yes.
It doesn't say anything about...
Not specifically officers, yeah. But...
It says supervision. Well, supervision implies a hierarchy. Now, when I say hierarchy, what we usually find is these the people are all worked up about things like a top-down type of church government. In other words, where these people get into office and then they lord it over the people, and it comes down from all decrees come down from above. And I said, no, that's not a Presbyterian system.
No,
that's not the way the Presbyterians understand the biblical system. In fact, if you look at the book of Acts, at least two places in the book of Acts, where it talks about deacons and elders, 1 Timothy 3, 1 Peter 1 and 3, I believe, Titus 2. There are all kinds of places where it talks about the specific offices of the elder and the deacon.
Sure.
And when it talks about the office, the elder and the deacons are servants. They're not, do they rule? Yes. But they do so in the role of a servant.
Yes.
So in other words, it's a bottom-up system. Deacons and elders are chosen from among the flock by the flock. And the reason that things like 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 2 and 1 Peter 1 and 3 exist is to show you what the criteria are for what you're supposed to choose. It's a shepherding position. You're operating it as a representative of Christ and of and of the congregation, which is a very sobering thought, by the way, for those of us who are elders. It's a very sobering fact.
Yes, it is.
But don't get the idea that somehow there's such a thing out there. You know, God had an intention for us to live in a theological anarchy. No, he didn't. He set up people in pastoral positions. Now, I'm not saying I'm a pastor. I'm a ruling elder and not a teaching elder. And our particular denominations have slightly different views on that, but not much. We have what's called in our system a 2.5 office, which is really a 2 office, elder and deacon. The difference being that a TE is also an elder, but he has ordination and a degree. He has higher learning. It's someone put it in our session said, well, he's the professional, we're the amateurs. That's why I said, nah, I'm not seeing it that way.
Yeah, well, that's okay. That's all right. You know, everybody's got their own viewpoints on this thing,
exactly.
I suppose. Well, anyhow. But, you know, when you get right down to it, Chuck, we need to be people of the book.
Yes.
We need to first study Scripture. Then we look at everything else. We figure out what's going on in society and things of that nature. And when you do it that way and you understand human nature and you understand the nature of sin and you understand the nature of man's position, it's easier, as you've sometimes made claims, of having a crystal ball.
Yes.
Well, you know what? And that's how we're going to start off when we're going to our updates.
Where we're actually going today. Yeah, 20
minutes
updates. In. 20 minutes
no,
in, we finally get where we're going.
It's perfectly fine because, you know, we have to, like, warm everybody up to it first. But where we're going today is, folks, last week we reported on some things about nuancing Obamacare. Well, guess what, folks? Nuancing doesn't work. And I think we told you that in some fashion. But sure enough, over the week, there was a great article in the American Spectator online at spectator.org by David Catrone, who wrote in his headline, The employer mandate is a goner.
Yeah, of course it is. Yeah.
And we I think we said that too. You know, this whole thing about Obamacare and needing to, you know, we need to nuance it a little bit more. Well, nuancing really, and we've known this for a long time, Chuck, because we study things through those lenses. We've talked to our listeners about this. Hopefully they've known it too. Because when you're Christian, constitutionalist, and conservative, you put things through those three lenses, you can usually come up with pretty good answers. And our pretty good answer was the only way to nuance this and fix it is to defund it and invalidate it.
Yeah, exactly.
In other words, repeal, not replace.
Right.
And that's what the spectators come up with, because guess what? Sure enough, as John Boehner and company are trying to do head counts and nose counts, they're coming to find out that there's quite a few people in their caucus who don't agree with the replace, don't repeal mantra. They actually like it the other way around, the way we like it, with the repeal, don't replace. So what's happened is that, as we've known, the administration put out a notice that they were going to postpone the deadline implementation for the employer mandate. Now, Chuck, I want you to kind of give a little background of our listeners who don't understand all this. When they hear the words employer mandate, they're not sure exactly what we're talking about.
Well, basically, there is a rule that goes along with Obamacare and the 29,000 pages of Obamacare that Nancy Pelosi said we had to pass before we could know what was in there. This is one of the things that was found in there. And what the employer mandate basically says is that if your business is over a certain size, and I forget what it is, I think
50 employees,
you have to provide health care coverage for that, for the all those employees, all 50 of those employees, or there's a fine.
Yes, that's now, what it says.
The fine, originally people were telling everyone, you know, it's going to be cheaper to actually pay the fine than it is to
provide
the coverage. Well, the IRS heard that cry, and they came out and set the fines. And the fines were going to be $100 per day per employee.
Right. So if you've got 50 employees, that would be $5,000 a day.
Well, okay. Think about it this way. $100 a day for an employee is $36,500 a year.
Correct.
Times 50.
Right.
So it's
365,000 times 5, it's $1.8 million.
Dollars, yeah.
Yeah.
So if you've got roughly 50 employees, now do you think it's going to cost you $100 a day to insure someone? Well, that's a good question, because with what Obamacare requires you to cover, it might cost you $100 a day per employee, especially if you've got his family, and you do. Because remember, Obamacare raised the age limit to 26. So if you keep your entire family and you've got four or five kids under the age of 26, that's going to be your. And not only that, you can't throw out pre-existing conditions. Everyone, even if they're past menopause, must have maternity care, and that's because the cost is so high, it has to be socialized to make it possible to pay it. So with all that being said, all these rare diseases and taking care of children who are born at 27 weeks and that kind of thing, which can cost millions of dollars, and we already know that, and that's already being taken care of, it could cost $100 a day per employee.
Well, you know, if you figure it out correctly, I had an overnight stay in the hospital a month and a half ago.
Which we, if the people remember, we prayed for you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Just now got all the bills from that, from all the doctors and the tests and everything else. We're looking at over $6,000 for one day. Okay. Now, if you figure out that per day over a month, well, that's $200
a day. A day.
So, if it's taking a fine at $100 a day versus paying $200 a day, and that was only for a one-day stay, folks, what would have happened if I'd have been in there a week? a month, 6 weeks, like some people are with serious health issues. Well, if you're an employer, guess what? Find me. One employee, one day, $200 for a month, or 2 months worth of $100 a day for them to stay one day in the hospital.
Well, remember, the whole plan is to make this affordable, quote unquote, and we're doing the thing like we did last week with our fingers in the air, and you can't see, quote
That's
unquote.
That's right. Yeah, the air quotes.
Air quotes. It's to socialize the cost. In other words, spread it out. So they're hoping that no one else in whatever your pool is had to spend a day or however much time in the hospital, and that that cost will be evened out by that idea. The fact is that doesn't work because so many of these ultra-rare conditions that are now having to be covered, and you know, nobody liked being cut out of coverage because they had some ultra-rare condition. But guess what? I have a not-so-ultra-rare condition. I have type 2 diabetes, and it has other consequences.
Uh-huh.
I'm more expensive to insure. There's just no doubt about that. I cost more money to insure. I have drugs I have to buy. I have treatments I have to go through from time to time. Now, I've got mine pretty well under control, so I'm more or less like I was before, except I take a couple of things that cost me about $20 a month to cover it. But there are people that I know who aren't so blessed and fortunate as me.
Yes.
God has blessed me greatly, and I give thanks for that. The fact is, there are some people that are on some very expensive stuff because they have very serious control issues.
Oh, absolutely.
Both type 1s and type 2s, my sister-in-law being one, although she's in pretty good shape as well. She's a type 1. That kind of stuff gets real expensive real fast, especially since the concept of a hospital has changed from what it was 40 or 50 years ago, when a hospital was a place where you went and got treated, and they kept the costs as low as they could.
Mm-hmm.
Do they do that anymore? No, they don't, because hospitals are now for profit.
Right, and most of the time they have to deal with insurers, and so they boost the costs up so that when the insurers negotiate it down, they still make a profit.
Sure. They jack it up by 35 or 40% so they can give 35 or 40%
sure they
in
do.
Discounts.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, you try and get that. You can do it.
Well, because I'm on Samaritan Ministries, a little plug for Samaritan, part of my responsibility to them is to try to negotiate the bill down. And I would say that I was somewhat successful because I was able to get about 37% reduction in the total bill.
That's not bad.
Might have been because I'm a lobbyist.
Well, you do have some expertise in that area, yeah.
Yeah, and talking people into doing things that they don't want to do. Yeah. Yes, that's my expertise. So, anyhow, but the point is, and going back to this article, you know, conservatives have been saying for a long time what this is going to do. It's going to hurt the employees.
Yes. Overall.
And what were the big proponents of Obamacare saying? Oh, you're looking out for the greedy, money-grubbing, profit-taking, big, bad corporations. Well, what are they finding out? Well, why did Obama suspend the implementation? Well, Chuck, maybe because it's an election year for the midterms, and it's not looking so good for the Democratic Congress because they're getting tied to this, because now more employers and individuals who are now getting their Obamacare payments, figuring out how much it's going to cost them versus their private insurance they had before, lo and behold, they're paying sometimes 300, 400, 500% more than they were paying before. And this was including like staunch rank and file Obama supporters, Obamacare supporters, the folks that were out there making noise about how horrible and heartless all of we conservatives were, because we were saying this is a boondoggle and it's going to end up, you know, destroying healthcare. Well, they're starting to realize that, first of all, it's going to destroy political careers.
Yes.
So what happens to this is, well, basically they're worried that it's going to hurt the Democrats in their holding control of the Senate and trying to pick up seats in the House. And that's true because what's happening, as we're finding, small employers who are at that 50 almost to that 50?
Yeah, they're 49.
Well, they're not hiring anymore.
Yeah. They're not expanding.
Because I could hire that 50th person and get kicked with this $100 a day fine for each of the 50 or the $1.825 million a year. Or I could stay at 49 people, really push the rest of my employees to pick up the slack because we really need the other person, and still and pay them better wages because it's still saving me money. I mean, if you think about it, $100 a day, that's $3,000 a month. If I gave everybody in my shop and that's per person, if I gave everybody in my shop a $1,500 a month raise, it's only costing me half as much as it would if I hired that 50th person and ended up having to pay the fines.
Well, yeah. Well, not only that, but of course, you've got other costs of hiring another employee.
Oh, sure. There's workers' compensation, Social Security. There's OSHA issues. If the employee gets hurt on the job, there's training costs.
Right.
There's the cost of absenteeism and you name it. I mean, honestly, I feel for a lot of small businesses because it's tough to balance all of this and still figure out how you're going to maybe feed your own family while you're providing for everybody else who's saying they want $15, $20, $30 an hour. They want full health care coverage from you, and they want the schedule that they want, and how dare you be heartless and not give them exactly what they want. Now, I'm being a little stereotypical here because most employees are not like that, but there are enough of them out there who are just like that to create some serious headaches for small businesses.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that don't understand that what you do in a job is it doesn't belong to you.
Right. Now the other trick, and this is where these supporters of Obamacare really messed up, larger corporations who have a lot more than 50 employees, they figured out how to get around it. We're just going to cut everybody's time down to 30 hours or less. Because if they're below 30 hours, we don't have to cover them. We'll hire a bunch more people, but we're going to hire them in at a part-time rate.
Well, and you know what? I'm trying to remember who did this. It was the Department of Labor or the Department of or the Internal Revenue Service basically put the decree out because they knew that the old rules were that 36 hours was the threshold for full time. So they were working people 35.
Right.
Well, no, now it's 30.
30, so they're working people 29. Yes.
My wife went through that.
And I'm sorry, but ladies and gentlemen, what that does is, and honestly, you know, you can get mad at the employer, but the employer is just trying to survive so that there is a job for that person to be there. And that they are still feeding their own family and, actually maybe making a profit on their labor, on their own labor and their employees' labor. You got to understand that when government does these things in a vacuum, because, guess who was exempted from all the mandates?
Yeah, right.
The people who voted on it.
Yeah.
And they've never really, the vast majority of them have never run a business themselves. Because it's hard to run a business when you go straight into politics, or you've always worked for the government, or you've been an attorney in a big firm or something of that nature.
Yeah,
there's only, honestly, if you look at our Congress, there's a percentage of them who've never had to make payroll, who have never had to figure out a time schedule for employees, never had to figure out how to hire people or fire people. And haven't figured out how to balance a bottom line.
If you see a candidate that claims that they've got a degree from the Kennedy School of Government, you should run
the other
screaming the other direction.
But the key is, ladies and gentlemen, that what's happening is it's hurting not only the employers, but it's hurting the people that they employ. And, you know, we hear all these great glowing numbers supposedly coming out, and some of them are not so glowing, from the Bureau of Labor Statistics about how many new jobs are created. The one thing that you don't hear, and this is where you have to start thinking beyond the headlines, what percentage of those jobs are full-time employment and what percentage of those jobs are temporary, seasonal, or less than full-time?
There's another issue there, and I just saw a story, and I'm trying to find it. Yes, folks, we do have our computers on in front of us while we do this because things come up and, yes. and we remember things we've seen and didn't plan on using.
Well, there's an article that I want to get to here in a minute, but then there's something that just happened today surrounding that article.
Yeah, the number of people who are not employed, in other words,
92 million.
About 315 million
right,
people.
Right, 315 million people. So almost a third of our entire population is not, who could be employed are not employed.
And they can't be counted as unemployed because either they're completely out of the job market for whatever reason, or they've completed their 99 weeks of unemployment, so they no longer count as someone who's looking for a job, even though they may still be looking, although I keep hearing about people who've given up. How can you give up looking for a job? Now, I have not been in that position. I've been on unemployment for a very short time, but I've never stopped looking, as depressing as it is to not find one. You have to keep looking. But there are over 92 million. This is the highest number ever, and yet they're telling us that our employment rate, our unemployment rate is only 8.2%. Well, wrong. No, our honest unemployment rate is something around 15%. If we were to do real numbers of people who have stopped looking or are just off the rolls and used to be on the rolls, the fact is that the number of available positions is shrinking. Now, you'll see help wanted signs around, but there are a heck of a lot of people who used to make $25 an hour as skilled labor in a shop who are now asked to be greeters at Walmart or stand behind a cash register at a Speedway and sell lottery tickets and slushies. That's not a real job.
No, well, it's a job. It's not a full-time, right, be able to provide for your family kind
exactly.
of job.
Exactly. And these people will also not be able to afford Obamacare.
Oh, no, absolutely not. So basically, the administration has realized that what they've done is they've created a mess for themselves for the November elections.
Right.
And so now they're basically tacitly admitting, this thing's got to go. We're just going to delay it probably into infinity at this point. Because I'll tell you what, if they lose in the midterms and they lose control of the Senate, which may or may not happen, but if they don't pick up anything in the House, there is no way under God's green earth that they're going to be able to implement these mandates without a serious political bloodbath on their part.
Well, I'm going to make a statement, and you can take it as you will. The Republicans showed that they're not serious about repealing Obamacare at all.
Oh, no, not
even. And the way they did it was by not forcing the implementation on the date.
Yes.
If they had been serious about repealing it, they would have forced the administration and said, you're not delaying this. It's going into effect.
You have to do it.
You have to do it. Because what that would have done, the results would have been immediate, and the hue and cry to repeal it would have been resounding.
Yep, it would have been.
So instead, what we're getting is this, yeah, we'll let the Democrats own the fact that it's there, but we won't make them implement it. So we'll get just enough votes to take over both houses, but we won't have this overwhelming majority who will actually force us to do what we promised we would do, which was repeal. Although, as we talked about last week, John Boehner's always been repeal and replace.
Right, because he wants to have something, but he just wants to have the Republican version of it in case it actually happens to get popular, so right, they can pick up votes off of it. Well, we know right now it's not popular because even the people who were cheerleaders for it to begin with are now starting to realize what the true cost to them are,
right,
of the program. And now you have Democrats who are congressional Democrats who are jumping off the Obama bandwagon. They've had enough. They know it's political suicide for them to be tied to this president and to this particular policy. And I say bravo, because if you get enough of that, if you get enough of the untenable, perhaps maybe some of our enlightened citizens in Congress might actually back into what would be real reform, which is going back to a free market system.
Oh, we can't have that.
I can't have that. I know. But, okay, we'll leave that where it is. There's another article that I want to talk about here because, as we talked about with Camp, we're going to have Larry Pratt from Gun Owners of America up. This is a great time to have Larry in Camp because of all the things that are going on over gun issues. As a matter of fact, just a couple of days ago, on one of our favorite websites, on Breitbart.com, there was an interesting article about an interview that was done with the head of a group called Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America.
Yeah.
Okay, Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Remember the name of this group, because this is like the Brady campaign, just basically renamed. Basically, they're for stopping any private gun ownership, really, is what it gets down to. Well, over the weekend, on some of the Talking Head shows on Sunday morning, the founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, Shannon Watts, was being interviewed by CNN, and the interviewer said something. Now, this is coming from Breitbart.com, and basically the interviewer asked Shannon Watts, said, "I want to challenge you on something, Shannon." Wayne LaPierre, who's executive director of the National Rifle Association, after Sandy Hook, said the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. And I think, essentially, this is still the interviewer saying, what they're saying is they want their wives to be able to carry, to be the good person with the gun. Is there an example in school shootings or a mall shooting or these public facilities where that's been wrong? Where a bad guy with a gun has been stopped in any other way or by a person other than a law enforcement officer with a gun or by killing himself? So, okay, so he's saying, is there anything out there where anybody has stopped somebody with a gun? Well, Shannon Watts, thought this was a softball question, and so she went swinging for the bleachers.
So she whiffed.
She went swinging for the bleachers, and she said, "This has never happened. Oh. Data shows it doesn't happen." Okay?
Yeah.
And she was pretty forceful about it. Funny thing was, if you start taking a look at some of these shootings, it does happen.
Yeah, it happens.
It does
a lot.
Happen. Now, some of the ones that Breitbart have shown. Now, remember, the interviewer tried to delimit it by saying a law enforcement officer or somebody else with authority. Well, a few of them, in February of 13, an armed guard in Atlanta subdued and disarmed a shooter in an Atlanta middle school, right?
Yep.
If you remember a while back at the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C., a guy came in with the intent of killing a number of their staffers, and he was taken down after shooting their security guard. But he was taken down. December 16th of 13, Arapahoe High School shooting lasted only 80 seconds because the school's armed resource officer closed in on the shooter who subsequently killed himself. But that wouldn't count in Shannon's world.
No, because, okay? Yeah.
On June the 6th, Breitbart reported on how a good guy with a gun stopped a bad guy with a gun who was attacking a courthouse in Georgia. That was a private citizen. Shannon, guess what? This interview was June 7th. That happened on June 6th.
Oops.
She's not keeping up with the news.
No.
Ah, and speaking of not keeping up with the news, and that's the reason why, and you don't even have this yet because I just pulled it up. This just happened today as we're recording this Tuesday.
The Oregon shooting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Suspect dead and one student killed after shooter with a semi-automatic weapon and, quote, dressed in black with a helmet and body armor, unquote, invaded Oregon High School. Well, guess what, folks? This person had a serious intent. He came into the gymnasium to shoot a bunch of people. He ended up shooting one student dead and wounding a coach, but when he was surrounded by armed officers in the locker room, something occurred, and he ended up dead. Now,
yeah, we don't know
whether it's him shooting himself or not. But the point is, folks, a good guy with a gun isn't just the average citizen on the street. It can be the armed school resource officer. It can be law enforcement who are doing the right thing and stopping and a situation from happening. However, we know full well And law enforcement will be honest about this. Their response times to incidences can be up to a half an hour before they can get to the place and understand what's going on. A lot of damage can be done in a half an hour, but if somebody who's there, whether it's the citizen on the street near the Georgia courthouse, whether it's the armed school resource officer standing in the school who took down the threat in 80 seconds, or whether it's the law enforcement team who get there because things go well and they get there quickly, who stop large shootings from happening. It isn't so much about how we ban guns. It's about who gets access to guns.
Well, okay, let's think about another case that just happened, I think, this last weekend, and that's the case out in Las Vegas where the couple went in and basically...
Suicide by cop?
Yeah. Well, essentially what they did was they walked into a Cece's Pizza and shot two policemen who were just simply sitting and having a little bit of pizza for dinner, stole their guns, walked across the street into a Walmart. Well, what happened at that point? They were confronted by an armed citizen.
Yes, they were.
Now, what did they do to that guy? They killed him. But he slowed him down enough that the rest of the police got there, and they didn't last too long after that. In fact, she shot him and then killed herself. Did the cops have to shoot him up? Nope. Once they were confronted, and seriously confronted, they took the coward's way out.
Yes, they did.
She shot him, shot herself. So the fact is, they were confronted by not one good guy with a gun, but two good guys with a gun. And I've got a story here that police, the armed civilian who confronted the Las Vegas attacker, is a hero.
Yes.
In other words, they didn't come out and do what they would do in Chicago or in New York or in Washington, D.C., and call him a nutcase and say he's a fool and he shouldn't have done that, should have left it to the professionals. They called him a hero. Why? Because he's a hero. He really is a hero.
Yes.
He stood up to two obviously very dangerous people. And, yeah, it got him killed. But he interposed.
But you see, Chuck, that's part of the issue. The average citizen, if allowed to be armed, will be heroic.
Yes.
You know, whether it's protecting your own family if they happen to be in the situation, or it's protecting complete strangers in a Walmart. When you see somebody threatening bodily harm to somebody, we don't turn and walk around and go the other way. We usually engage to defuse the situation, slow the situation down, or stop the situation from happening.
There was a story not 2 weeks ago about a restaurant that posted a sign, no concealed carry on this premises. The same day they were robbed.
Yep.
And some of the employees were pistol whipped. Okay. Well, the owner was some kind of a really far left, ideologue. And he said that was fine with him. Well, okay. Fine. Ask me if I'm going to go into his restaurant.
Nope.
No.
Nope.
Are you kidding? He's got advertising out front that says, don't worry, no one armed here.
No one armed in here, so we're a free shooting gallery. And that's sad, Chuck, because that's...
And I get the same feeling when I walk into a place. Now, when I was in another church, they had a school attached, and they were required to hang a sign that said, this is a gun-free premises. And I said, I think we should take that sign down. Well, we have to, and I said, it needs to come down. Well, why do you say that? I said, because what it says is, don't worry, there's no one armed here to stop you.
That's right. That's exactly what it says. And we find that the MO of most shooters is that they're cowards.
Yes.
To start with. And they only go and go into places where they expect the balance of power to be in their favor. Well, if you have law-abiding citizens who carry, and honestly, Chuck, I'm not a big concealed carry fan. Now, most people are going to be like, well, you big liberal. No, I'm not a liberal. I believe concealed carry is unconstitutional. I believe we have the right under the Second Amendment to be able to carry whether openly or concealed without getting authorization from a government agency.
Well, that's right. I agree.
I believe in what's called constitutional carry, which means if I have a legally possessed firearm, which means I don't have a criminal background and I'm not a felon and I'm not on parole, I'm a citizen, and I buy that firearm, and if I want to slap it on my hip, put it on my belt, as the old country song says, wear my gun outside my pants for all the honest world to feel. Yeah, I'm going to be doing that. I'm not going to go and beg the county sheriff or the city cops or whomever it might be to qualify me, test me, and make me sign a bunch of paper giving them all my personal information for me to be able to do what is my constitutional right to keep and bear arms. Period. Now, whether I carry it under clothing or on top of my clothing, and I'm more of an on-top kind of guy, if more of us were doing that, there would be fewer shootings. Because when these cowards try to come into a school or a restaurant or a Walmart or a McDonald's, and they realize that, I could be walking in there and there may be 10 people with sidearms, any one of whom can drop me like a hot rock immediately.
Yes.
Guess what? Either they're going to take up long-range snipering, or they're going to drop it and start realizing that they got a problem and they need help.
Now, I'll tell you what. That person in Oregon did a calculation.
Of course.
And he calculated the odds. And he apparently miscalculated the odds, which is exactly why we need to be allowed to conceal carry in all kinds of different places. So these people can recalculate the odds and say, it's getting longer and longer and longer and longer for me to be able to pull this off.
Yep.
Because had two more people, for instance, if you read what happened in this case out in Vegas, where she killed this guy who was a hero, the way she had to do it was pretend like she was a shopper and sneak up behind the guy who had the drop on her husband.
Yeah. So, the situation is that people, regardless of what you do with guns, there are going to be people who are just not stable and who are going to do things. Now, if you ban guns, they start using knives or shop tools or whatever they can get their hands on.
Or guns they stole. Which is what happens. You'll hear the boo-hooing in D.C. And I've heard this argument over and over and over again, and it's laughable. The reason that we still have gun crime in D.C., even though guns were banned, and that was before the decision, I can't remember the name of it now. But in essence, they said the reason is because all these guns that are pouring in from Virginia. Oh, you mean people are actually going out and practicing their right to keep and bear arms in Virginia and forcing people who want to pull these crimes to go into a place where people aren't armed?
Yeah.
Isn't that what you mean?
That's what they mean.
Well, hold on. Why aren't all these violent criminals doing their violent crime in Virginia? Because the odds are too long.
Yes, that's exactly right.
The odds are too long.
Much too long. Now, speaking about long odds in Virginia, that leads us into our last thing we need to talk about. I love how you get me those on-ramps. Okay. There are some people in Virginia who know how to play the political game.
Yes, they do.
And they're smart about it. As you know, Virginia is considered somewhat of a blue state, maybe a purple state, because their new governor is Democrat, former Democrat national strategist Terry McAuliffe. Well, Terry McAuliffe just got a lesson in politics this week. Beautiful lesson, too. Brought by the Republican Senate caucus in Virginia. Now, Virginia has 40 senators, and they were sitting there working on, the thing that we've been working on in Ohio unsuccessfully, and that is Medicaid expansion. I say unsuccessfully from our position because we didn't get it banned.
Right.
But the point is, they were deadlocked. 2020. 20 Democrats, 20 Republicans, and the vote was split 2020. So Terry McAuliffe was pushing and pushing and pushing to try to get expand Medicaid under Obamacare, because obviously Terry McAuliffe is a good Obama supporter and flunky, and he wants to help spread that spread the love, the Obama yeah, love across the country. Well, Terry got a schooling, as they say.
He got a real schooling.
Because the Republicans got smart. And what they did was that they talked one of the Democrat state senators, a guy by the name of Philip Puckett, into making a swap. Now, what did he swap? He swapped his seat, and he stepped down from the Virginia Senate for an opportunity for them to support him, because they would have control at that point. It'd be 20-19 for a position on the state tobacco commission and greenlighting his daughter's chance for getting a local judgeship, which the state senate appoints as well. Guess what? Puckett's no fool. He made that deal.
You bet he did.
He made that deal. He resigned his seat, and that means that he is probably going to get appointed to this now. You know, they'll scream and yell, and the governor, McAuliffe, will scream, and the Democrats will call him a traitor and an Uncle Tom and whatever else they want to call him. But the key was the Republicans just did the electoral math.
Yeah.
And they got smarter than Derry McAuliffe was. They figured out where this guy's sweet spot was. What did he really, really want? Did he want to sit there and be Terry McAuliffe's lapdog for the rest of this term? Well, or did he want to move up and onward, probably extending his public employee's retirement, because probably a seat on the state tobacco commission pays an awful lot more money than a state senate seat does.
And essentially, it's a sinecure.
Exactly.
And if you don't know what that is, folks, look it up.
Yeah,
it's a sinecure. A sinecure is a job that basically has a lot of kudos and pay and benefits
and very little
responsibility.
Very
yes.
little work. That's right. Well, the Democrats are freaking out about this, and they're saying Republicans were trying to buy the Senate with job offers in order to thwart health care coverage to 400,000 low-income Virginians. Well, as we've just talked about earlier, those 400,000 low-income Virginians are probably better off without Obamacare, because they may right. actually still have jobs.
Right.
And they may not be paying some 500-600% more for their health care coverage than they are right now. I got to hand it to the Senate Republicans. They're smart. They understood the electoral math. They understood, number one, that those appointments, those nominees, go through them for authorization. So they understood their Constitution. And number two, they understood that 20-19 means a win.
Yeah, exactly.
20-19 means a win. And my guess is they probably have someone lined up in his Senate district as a Republican who could probably take the seat.
Yeah, now I don't know the Virginia. We'll have to talk to our friend Tom DeWeese and see
about
what
Virginia's standards are.
How you do that, whether the governor appoints or if they do a special election. Depends.
Yep. Well, and they may have to leave it setting open until the next election.
Possibly.
But right now, the Republicans now control the Virginia Senate 20-19, which means that, number one, Obamacare expansion is dead in Virginia. Number two, the poor former Democratic Senator Philip Puckett is probably going to be the next state tobacco commissioner. And number three, former Senator Puckett's daughter is probably going to be a sitting judge.
Well,
soon.
There's another guy here who was probably going to end up being the Senate president.
Yes.
Who will not be
the Senate president. That's right, yeah. Because it just switched party control, which was another great thing, because now the new Republican leadership-controlled Senate will probably use that position now to go after the governor and really create some dynamic tension in the state of Virginia, which, honestly, that's what's missing in Ohio.
That's what's missing in Ohio. We have single-party rule, and it's not working out very well.
No. Well, it's working out well for those who want to use it for their own ends.
Yeah, well,
but
exactly.
It's not working out so well for the rest of the citizenry.
Which is us.
That would be us. That's right.
Such political log rolling. And I'll be quite honest, I watched the reaction from places like the Daily Beast and Politico and the Slate, and they are apoplectic over this. And they, I saw headlines that said it was just simply a bribe, all kinds of just disparaging. And of course, it's never been done on the other side of the aisle, ever, not once. Nothing like that's ever been done to Republicans. Oh, I forgot about remember when Jim Jeffords was offered a committee chairmanship to jump ship?
Yes.
From Vermont?
Yes.
To jump ship from the Democrat, from the Republicans to the Democrats? Oops, I guess we forgot about that.
Yeah, well, and wasn't that something that Terry McAuliffe helped corral?
Oh,
if I remember correctly,
so, yes.
I think he was chairman of the DNC at that point.
That's right. oops, it's different. That as someone in the comm box on this article on on Breitbart said, well, that's different. Being sarcastic, of course.
Well, of course. It's different. Yeah, it's different.
Well, folks, we've given you an eclectic program this week, and we are out of time.
I just do have to say one thing, though. The Republicans learned how to be nuanced.
Nuanced. That's right. They were nuanced in this situation. That being said, we would ask that you join us again next week. We're going to have a rerun for you while we're at camp. Join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.